Blog Talk Radio.
I'm going to go into a side room. Tap me if I don't come back.
Hi, sorry.
General
Porter,
General Porter,
Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime. And good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to Midrats. This is Sal, along with my co-host, the ever genial Eagle One from Eagle Speak. Hope everybody is enjoying June now that she's finally here. And now we're back for a live edition of Midrats. Now, for those that have been with us here for a long time, you're going to recognize our guest today. And today we're going to look at what are the national security implications for the 2012 election. And our guest today is returning guest Mackenzie Eaglin, who's now with the American Enterprise Institute. Mackenzie, welcome to Midrats.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Oh, really glad to hear you. It's interesting in that I was looking back to previous elections. You know, obviously national security issues were top shelf in 04 and obviously in 08 as well, as the self-described anti-war movement wanted to keep beating that drum. But when you look back further, it almost seems as if we're in a place where national security is a little more than it was in the 2000s. President Clinton's reelection campaign back in the 90s. But there's something in the background, though. It almost seems as if we're just waiting for an event to break it out from the economics and the budgetary issues. Well, where do you see national security issues right now?
I completely agree with your assessment, Sal. I don't see them as a front burner issue, but they are simmering. The water is boiling, I mean, to be honest with you, in terms of global problems and challenges. And, you know, all you have to do is, you know, turn on your internet and read some news, whether it's Syria or North Korea or Iran, and the challenges are just mounting around the world, and we are doing everything we can to not use military options right now, or I'd say this administration, excuse me. And, you know, understandably, and I understand why they're doing that in many cases, but this is something that's going to come up and as a headline between now and the election, because, as you said, something's going to happen, and there is a feeling of anticipation, and not necessarily in a good way, that things are going to happen, you know, whether that's an Israeli strike on Iran or something totally different, like their program's more advanced than we think it is. And so I actually see this coming up quickly at some point, but right now I think that the two men running for the office really want to keep the focus on the economy and jobs, and I get why they would do that as well. You know, but I think Governor Romney as a candidate is going to try and push national security more as an issue, and President Obama is going to welcome that because he is proud of his record as commander-in-chief. And so it's going to be an interesting 6 months.
Well, let's take a look at that, because you had an interesting presentation to Congress on the size of the Navy and its looming inability to meet the commitments it has. Can you kind of discuss that a little bit in terms of what exactly Mr. Obama should be proud of and what Mr. Romney is pushing for?
Yes. You know, the Navy as an institution and as a service is a beloved service on Capitol Hill, as you might imagine. Part of that is just because the Navy tells its story so well. There are many reasons for it. You know, Governor Romney, as part of his candidacy, he has outlined some specifics in terms of national security objectives, where you can get a sense of where, you know, he might go as president with a national military strategy. And he's focused heavily on the Navy and heavily on missile defense. And, you know, part of that is because you know, if we look back to another campaign that wasn't Bill Clinton's, but the one before that, Ronald Reagan, you know, those were days when, as part of his active platform, candidate Reagan ran on a 600-ship Navy, and of course that still comes up in current Navy circles all the time and policy debates. I think this White House feels vulnerability on the pivot to Asia, yet shrinking and aging the Navy and the Air Force. And this is something that Mitt Romney was already talking about anyway. It just so happens that this is now becoming, I think, will grow as an election issue. When I testified before Congress this year, it was to talk about the 30-year shipbuilding plan. And, you know, the promises for the Navy right now in this administration are that you get to pivot to Asia in fiscal year 2018. That's the guarantee that Navy leadership has been given so that they'll sign off on all these budget cuts. But as we all know, that's monopoly money in Washington. That's another president's term. I mean, that's literally beyond the next administration's 4 years. And it's a really a wing and a prayer kind of strategy. And it's if you look at the near term and the immediate and what actually matters. So put aside the rhetoric and you look at the dollars. The Navy is retiring more ships than it's building every single year in this current administration's budget. And, you know, members of Congress are fully aware of this mismatch between the words that they're hearing from administration officials that all is well, the pivot is happening, and don't worry about these budget cuts, you know, generically, of course, I'm speaking. And then they look at the numbers and they see what's actually happening to the U.S. Navy.
Yeah, I've always found it'll be fixed in the out years to be the classic beltway punt. I mean, it's done all the time. You think after a while, Charlie Brown and Lucy, people would push back a little bit. And maybe we can because, you know, when you talk about the shift to the Pacific, and I know an announcement was made, you know, 60% of the effort going towards the Pacific, but you made a very good point, especially when you look at military programs and shipbuilding, aircraft, everything, that the impact of the future really is those decisions are made now. And I look back a little bit over a decade, and there was a big promise put out there. We're going to retire all these ships early. I mean, some of the Spruances were retired when they still had 10 years of active life left to go or more. And we're going to recapitalize. We're going to take this money, and all these savings are going to be used to create fleets full of DDGs 1000s. Of course, we now know that's a three-ship trial run, and then we'll have CGX, which we know has been canceled, and then there would be the DDGX, which has also decided to die. So here we find ourselves wanting to do a Pacific pivot. Our answer to that is the Flight 3 Arleigh Burke. Arleigh Burke's been a great ship, but there are, I guess it's the only show in town. And last time we pivoted to the Pacific prior to World War II, a lot of our success in World War II, where whether you're looking at the fast battleships that we built in the decades before, if you look at the fleet submarines, if you look at the long-range aviation, it all was done with an appreciation of the tyranny of distance in the Pacific. And here we are looking at a out-years shift to the Pacific, but the only real combatant, and there's some interesting conversations about how their shipbuilding plan, they got their numbers. The only combatant they're talking about of any numbers is an LCS, which is uniquely poorly suited for any type of actions in the Pacific due to ranges and everything else. Are there some other options from a shipbuilding point of view that we could realistically look at perhaps building a platform or providing the Navy with an existing platform that meets the challenges that we see in the Pacific from a logistics and a weaponeering point of view?
I sure do hope so, you know, because the need for the CGX or DDGX or the combination of the two, MSX, Major Surface Combatant, MSCX, I guess, is necessary and for a variety of reasons, national security reasons, but not the least of which, of course, is, you know, the sort of the maintaining that design and engineering workforce. I think there's a lot of potential in the trial run DDG 1000 program. You know, it was curtailed due to budget reasons. At the end of the day, you know, that's the bottom line. The Navy said it was for a bunch of other reasons, but, you know, there was a whole host of issues that led up to that program's collapse, including partly the customer adding too many requirements into one program. But there are a lot of next-generation technologies and leap-ahead developments as part of the DDG 1000 including all the way down to the railgun. And I think that a lot of that know-how and learning curve can and should not go to waste because when you only build three of anything, it is incredibly expensive. It's only fair to the taxpayer to put that money and knowledge to good use. Doesn't necessarily mean the whole of the DDG 1000 is the future for a CGX, but by all means, you know, I would tell, if I'm the Navy and I'm thinking about this, you know, I would want for sort of a blue sky approach to it. I understand that budget constraints, it's usually the opposite. We're seeing this in the Air Force right now. They want a next generation bomber, but what they're really looking at budgetarily is a bomber that is a marginal leap from what we have today. So, you know, there's a, we're riding a seam, and that's the key difference. And I don't know what that budget can support in the next, you know, if this administration wins a second term, that the Navy will get what it needs for a truly revolutionary capability. Maybe that's not what's needed. Maybe the Navy says, you know what, numbers still matter just as much as these technologically advanced capabilities that we hear from Undersecretary Work all the time. But it's a valid requirement. It's needed yesterday. You know, when CGX dropped off silently, I think this was at the end of the last administration from the budgets, and we were never to be heard from again. It was something that should have been talked about and debated at the time. You know, why was it ever in there? Why did the Navy think it needed it 3 CNOs ago, and what changed? The good news is, on the aviation front, if you are somebody like me and actually studies these 30-year plans down to granular levels of detail, the Navy actually is asking for a next-generation air dominance fighter, which I think is interesting for a couple of reasons. May or may not, you know, we can debate whether that's merit-worthy, but, you know, the Air Force is not thinking of a next-generation air superiority fighter. And so the Navy's kind of out front on this. And I think that there should be that conversation. You know, why do we need that program, and what could we apply to other things? Because if the Navy were to go down that road, basically what you could, in theory, I think, could happen is you could take a lot of that development work and design and engineering thinking and apply it to unmanned systems aboard Navy ships. And I know there's a couple of programs underway right now, looking at better precision strike and loitering capabilities for the Navy. But, you know, if there's those kinds of benefits where, you know, it spreads across programs on the aviation front, I'd be all for it.
You know, in reading some of your stuff the last couple of days, Mackenzie, I just get the feeling you're not impressed with the sequestration process and the mess it's created. Could you kind of run down how we got here? And you mentioned a lot of, in your work, you've mentioned a lot of the long-term effects, such as our inability to lay out plans for the SSBNX and a lot of other assets that seem to be lying fallow right now. Can you kind of walk through that? Hello?
Oh, I apologize. Thank you. Yes, I've written a lot lately. I've talked a lot about sequestration, and the irony is it's a term only Washington could love, right? I mean, you almost have to joke that it was designed so that people couldn't talk about it because it's so hard to comprehend. But nonetheless, we had these automatic, you know, defense budget cuts up ahead if Congress doesn't change their debt ceiling deal. And, you know, right now, nobody is in the mood to change the deal for different reasons. The House has tried. The GOP-controlled House has tried to change the terms of the deal, but the Senate and the White House have said unless there are tax increases, we're not changing the deal, which on its face is absurd. I understand why the deal was created to reduce the debt if the supercommittee failed, and it did, but to use the military's budget as a hostage to tax and debt disagreements, which is basically what has happened, is just ludicrous, and it concerns me. It concerns me greatly, not just the sort of budgetary process and, you know, why they even came up with this deal in the first place. You know, there's always this conventional wisdom in Washington that the military-industrial complex is alive and well, and that, you know, somebody's always, you know, since everyone supports the troops, therefore the defense budget is always, you know, well-supported itself. I've actually seen a trend over the last 3 to 5 years that where support for just, you know, sort of just generic support for defense, a strong defense for a truly capable military and what that means and what it costs has been eroding. You know, and in many ways I see the military as a political orphan. And because everyone assumes that it's not, it contributes even further to this problem. And sequestration is, to me, a manifestation of this trend. And you know, it's ridiculous. Basically, what happens on January 2nd if Congress doesn't figure out, you know, another bill payer for these debt reduction cuts, it kicks in another $50 billion roughly in defense budget cuts about four months into the fiscal year. You know, I've been surveying those in the military whenever I get the opportunity to talk to them, and I always say, look, the defense budget cuts and capability cuts started 3 years ago, and it's usually a lagging indicator for layoffs to happen, say at a shipyard or furloughs in one case, or for those in uniform to start to feel the squeeze. But I've been going around asking people, you know, are you feeling it? Whether that's, you know, the drive for ever more efficiencies, right? That's a term we've been hearing a lot of from Pentagon leaders. Everything's going to be solved through efficiencies. And I'm hearing that it's blood from a stone. There are no more efficiencies. Efficiencies now just mean hacking billets and strength. And, you know, that sailors and soldiers and airmen and Marines are actually starting to now fully feel the effects of 3 years of defense budget cuts. And, you know, this sequestration coming on top of it, I mean, the Navy should know better than anybody who's been struggling with readiness issues, particularly the surface fleet, something I also care about and follow very closely. You can't hang you can't put this gun to the military's head and think that that's going to spur Washington to act when at the precise time that you don't need that funding uncertainty. Yes, the defense budget is huge. I'm not trying to say that it's not. But right now, it's a time for an honest discussion about it. That's something, unfortunately, I don't see bubbling up onto the election trail. You know, people aren't going to necessarily use the term sequestration, but I think that the defense budget cuts issue will start to come up more and more. You know, part of the sequestration is that DOD civilians, so, for example, a lot of Navy employees who do shipyard repair and overhaul work, for example, or Army depot workers in another case, DOD civilians will have to be notified in advance of sequestration by law, 30 to 60 days, depending on your employment status. Industry has to, by law, warn their shipbuilding, aerospace, and defense workforces 60 to 90 days in advance of furloughs or layoffs, which would put it right smack in the middle of October and 1 week before the election in November if it's 60-day notification. So I have to think at some point Congress and the White House are going to want to cut a deal so that these kinds of things don't happen, because that's been the point of all of my articles. Sequestration is something that in the calendar starts in January, but soft or partial sequestration starts any day now, and the Navy's going to feel it just as much as anyone else.
And the Navy's always been really capital intensive. And I've been thinking about the same thing that you discussed there, Mackenzie, about the general feeling in the background. And for a few months, I've been thinking, well, it's just people are tired. After a decade of low-boil conflict, people are just tired of it. But I think there's something else going in there. You know, one thing we have in the 2012 election, this is the first election we've had, I think it's ever, where neither candidate will have had any type of military service to speak of whatsoever. And when I look at the Hill, I would expect more from, I mean, Senator McCain comes up, but he's really reactionary. He's not at the front. I always thought that Senator Webb from the other side of the aisle might have been a bit more engaged than he was, but of course he's a lame duck now. And over the House of Representatives, you know, Representative Forbes, he's out there swinging his flail on a regular basis. But I really don't see advocates out there that are really advocates. You have some politicians who are reacting, who will go in for the quick score, but you don't have people on the Hill that either have the military background or the combination of background and seniority and desire to really lead the conversation. So it's really been left up to the vagaries of the executive branch that, you know, wants to do things like spend $24 a gallon on biodiesel for the world's greatest consumption of consumers of fuel. Any operations guy who's had to run a budget knows what a nightmare that is. So is that really part of the equation, that we've had a generational change where we really don't have a critical mass of people on the Hill that are willing to drive the conversation but instead are just reacting to the executive branch.
Honestly, I couldn't have said it better. I completely 100% agree with how you characterize the challenge. And I would describe it another way. And I let me start premises by saying on a foreign policy level, you know, we lost the sort of bipartisan consensus on the common threat, obviously, at the end of the Cold War. And ever since then, the fact that we still call it a post-Cold War, post-9/11 world is indicative in and of itself that we cannot figure out kind of what this new century is. I know President Obama dubbed it the Pacific century. I tend to want to hope it's still an American century. But, you know, there's no consensus on what the threats facing America are today. And, you know, I can say, Mackenzie can say it's Syria, it's all the ones we started out talking about. It's cyber, et cetera. And then, you know, the guy next to me or you could say, no, it's not. And that's the end of the conversation. We just have to just throw up our arms and disagree. That's a microcosm of kind of how the Hill conversation goes, unfortunately. And so because policymakers and you know, there's been this just, you know, general erosion in that education as well of just, you know, what our foreign policy objectives over time, which are largely unchanged, and are, you know, the what we expect of our hard power tool in the statesman toolbox, and what we expect it to do, and why that also is missing. And so what you have is a reaction, and that is exactly what happened. Policymakers lurch from crisis to crisis, acting only in response without managing and leading. And this is really a problem on the Hill in particular. And so that's the foreign policy. And we all know defense policy is you know, the son of foreign policy. And so if you don't have a clear foreign policy vision or leadership or statement or understanding that's somewhat common and bipartisan, then you have a defense policy in free fall, which means your budgets can go up and down and spike all over the place without any sort of long-term plan. You know, for a lot of the criticism I give the administration a lot of time, and it's never exclusive to just one party, that's for sure. I'm certainly not easy on anybody. But, you know, the pivot to Asia is actually probably a smart thing to do. This is something that the QDR independent panel identified 2 years ago, led by Bill Clinton's former Secretary of Defense and George W. Bush's National Security Advisor. They said pivot to Asia. And I think that's, you know, in so many words, and I think that's right. And they called specifically for increased Navy resources, among other things. And, but, you know, so the pivot's a great idea, and I think it's an important common vector for the entire Department of Defense to get behind. The problem is, like I said, right now it's just, it's a powerless pivot. It's a paper pivot. And what that's going to do is take a really good idea and undercut our credibility. Because I was just in Japan for a conference, for example, and we had some Japanese scholars there, some South Korean scholars, a China scholar. And basically, you know, the pivot's welcomed with a shrug. And they see, you know, the word's fine, great, but what they see is our presence and then therefore our influence declining. And so if we laud this pivot and nothing ever happens or comes of it, you know, I think that in 5 years when it's supposed to be properly resourced, everyone's just going to roll their eyes and nothing will happen. And so back to the Hill, you know, I think that you're right on in terms of larger member general education and how truly lacking it is. You know, a member typically will educate themselves on what is in their district, right? So if they have a depot or an arsenal or a shipyard, you know, they become, I hope, Army students or Navy students and Sea Power students and that sort of thing. And we've seen this time and again. What we are lacking more so, as you mentioned, are the members who can look across the armed services and be national security leaders. It's not just about their district. We have an Air Force base that happens to be National Guard. Therefore, I know everything about the Air National Guard. That's important, but we need it to be much more broad. And, you know, we're losing members like John Kyle. We've already lost members like Gene Taylor and Ike Skelton, you know, guys who I think did these things well. And so we do have a generational shift where you have, you know, right now still you have 100 freshmen on the Hill, and you have members who have been there longer but aren't going to just pick up that mantle when Kyle retires, for example, John Kyle of Arizona, to say, you know, I'm gonna become this person just because it's important as an issue to me. There's potential out there for some members like an Alan West, for example, you know, Kelly Ayotte, I've seen this on the Republican side. I'm sure there are some Democrats too. But it's generally lacking, and it's not going to help when you only have five members who can speak fluently and eloquently about all of defense policy. And so what, again, that will lead to is a defense budget that is subject to the whims and whipsaws of the executive branch. You know, whether if whatever happens in November, you could see the Defense Department have to start all over again. You know, if there's a new administration, you know, what you'll basically see is the continuation of DOD's endless state of strategic review, which is debilitating, and the budgets that already aren't matching it, which is affecting the service, you know, as we've talked about readiness in other ways. And this cycle is going to continue until we have more members who care about the bigger issues beyond their district and their state.
Well, part of that problem, and I'm curious as your thought, I mean, as the representatives and the senators seem to have been, the political parties seem to be more polarized than ever. I remember the days you could look across the aisle and see Scoop Jackson talking defense. Of course, that was quite a while ago. But there doesn't seem to be any of that, just what you're saying. There's none of that cross-party discussion anymore, because the leadership of one party seems to be mostly focused on giving as much money as they can to certain groups of people, and the other party seems to be focused on trying to stop that from happening rather than focusing on the national security issues. Is that just a layman's view, or is that actually what's going on over there?
No, I think, unfortunately, you are correct. And, you know, we are seeing that every other issue is, you know, more important, and defense continues to take a back burner. It started, you know, it's just shocking that we're even having this conversation when you put it in context of all the people you know and work with, and I know and work with. You know, it is a small community, a military or military-associated community. You know, it's just shocking that I'm sitting here telling you that this started 4 or 5 years ago. And maybe it is linked to larger national fatigue, you know, security fatigue or threat fatigue. I'm not really sure what it is, or coin fatigue. But, you know, I started to see this again under the last administration at the tail end. And, you know, that members of both parties were okay with just, you know, no conversation, just come on in and start cutting the defense budget. We're not going to discuss why, what purpose this budget serves. What is our foreign policy? What is it supposed to do? You know, part of that is due to very effective, very powerful secretaries of defense. You know, Robert Gates is just a master bureaucrat, and certainly proved that during his tenure serving two presidents. But, you know, this erosion has been underway for a while now, and I think it's accelerating, partly that have to do with things with foreign policy. But what it means is, even if we just put sequestration aside, the sort of, you know, the debt ceiling deal, defense budgets are going to go into a free fall that I think will be end up being steeper than any in a previous post-war drawdown, which is something we always do, which I think is completely flawed. But I think it'll go deeper than any previous ones, barring some crisis. And that's not how you're supposed to do this. You know, you don't build a military and then cut it to its knees and then try and build it up again in a hurry. You know, it's more expensive. It's completely inefficient. You don't really save any money from your drawdown the previous decade when you have to build back up again. And yet here we are again going back down that road as if it's a birthright for the nation to disarm after conflict. And, yeah, it is expensive to maintain an all-volunteer force. It absolutely is. But that is a national decision. And yet we can't seem to put our money where our mouth is and follow through on what that means. And I think you're right. I think this is both parties. Everybody's focused on something else, and it's not this. It's not a strong defense. It's not military strength, and it's not national security.
Yeah, I always – usually people just look at me and blink their eyes because it's kind of wonkish. I think it's wonk one. You know, I'll pick wonk for 100. It's a simple concept, but people don't want to grasp it. I go, but look at – military spending as a percent of GDP, it's really not that much. But that doesn't do us anything. And you've teed the ball up for me. I'll get into my question now. To go into what is a little bit of an uncomfortable area here, because, you know, we've been talking about lack of conversation on the Hill, lack of experience in executive branch as well. And this isn't the first time that, and I'll just stick with the Navy, that the Navy has found itself where it sees what needs to be done from a strategic point of view. What are the assets that the fleet needs in order to achieve that requirement? And when the conversation wasn't going this way, men in uniform, senior leadership, stepped forward to fill that vacuum of conversation. You can go back to the beginning of the previous century with Admiral Sims, who had a rather politically incorrect description of one of the latest new construction battleships we have, something about modern man. Couldn't believe modern men would produce such a thing. But he wrote letters directly to Theodore Roosevelt, and he was a continual gadfly for the Navy to produce what needed to be produced to accomplish what were the maritime requirements at that time. You can also go back to after the Second World War with the Revolt of the Admirals. You also had with McNamara's Whiz Kids, pre-joint, trying to force the F-111 on the Navy, and Vice Admiral Tom Connolly gave up his fourth star to stand up for what needed to be done. So we have this history at these moments and times, at these inflections, where people will step forward in uniform and perhaps go up to the edge of that envelope to do that. Is there an environment now that would prevent that type of effective, almost an aggressive opposition or an attempt to fill an information void by those in uniform? Or is that something that, for one reason or another, we no longer have leaders who are willing to take that step?
It's like we colluded on the questions, because I couldn't have thought of a better one that you could have asked me next. This is something I give a lot of thought to. Part of my job is a think tank, to be on the outside, but work closely with members of Congress, both parties, and senior military and civilian leadership in the Department of Defense. And I agree with your assessment that this is a unique time. It's not exclusive to the last 3 years of this administration by any sense, or this current Secretary of Defense. This started as a defense, wonk myself, I guess, been doing this a long time. This started maybe coinciding alongside 9/11. I'm not really sure, but Secretary Rumsfeld, he had a cult of personality, and he was powerful and intimidating, and he surrounded himself with a very small group of people. I worked in DOD at the Pentagon. 9/11 was actually my first day for 2 years, and I saw it in action. And because he had such a small group of advisors, those advisors had a lot of power. Many of them were very intimidating to the military leadership, and then we sort of progressed into the era of Robert Gates, and who's more of a quiet, powerful person. Didn't go around making splashy statements like old Europe all the time, but in fact was probably more powerful than Donald Rumsfeld. And because anybody who wasn't Rumsfeld was going to have this never-ending honeymoon with Congress, which he took and ran with. And that's not healthy for the department. This kind of gets back to other questions. The executive branch, there's a reason the Constitution has the president propose a budget and Congress dispose it. But it's not just the money and the cutting of the checks and the validation that goes along with that, and the research and the justifications, et cetera. But it's the oversight. Oversight is one of those dorky words that everybody just like pats you on the head and moves on. That's nice, McKinsey, you want oversight. No. Oversight is what prevents $600 hammers and prevents Abu Ghraibs from happening if you're doing it really well. And Congress, since 9/11, has given way too much deferential treatment to the executive branch, both political parties, whatever president controlled the executive branch. And so on the uniform side, look, I'm not a Joint Chief, so obviously I haven't walked a mile in their shoes. It's not a job I envy, that's for sure. But going, the Robert Gates era, what did we see start to happen? We started to see an environment of threat and intimidation sort of spill out into the open, where he has talked publicly about how proud he was for firing people. And what he basically said in a recent speech, now that he's out of office, is he believes strongly that you just fire people for no reason when you take office, because it sends a message. You're tough or whatever. that's one, slightly horrifying, but two, you know, it led to other things. We saw the Joint Chiefs had to start signing non-disclosure agreements about budgets that cut 50 major weapons programs in 2010 and 240 big and small programs all in one sweep of a pen, one budget, 2010. And they started having to sign non-disclosure agreements. Then they were starting to investigate leakers. I mean, you can start to see this culture in the building that's snowballing for years. And now I'm worried we have 3 and 4 stars, you know, all the way up to the top that have grown up in this Washington new defense way of doing business, and they're not fully speaking their minds. And, you know, we've heard a lot of senior Navy officials, both uniformed and civilian, say things like, we're fully on board with this new strategy, the budget is fine, there's nothing wrong here, we have no unfunded requirements, something that historically all the services have given to Congress without, oh, that was another thing Robert Gates started. He started oversight of the services' unbudgeted requirements list, and, unfunded requirements list. You know, everything's fine, nothing to see here. You know, they'll swear it on the blood oath of their firstborn. The problem is, with a straight face, no one in the military can say that there are zero unmet needs out there, but they're not allowed to talk about it. And then you can pile on top of that because, you know, of all of these things that have happened, and they know that their only option is to resign. That is the only thing that they can do right now to make the public statement. But all the generals and admirals that have been fired have not come out afterwards to talk very publicly. I mean, we haven't seen a General Mosley, you know, he was SACSA partly for the nuclear mission in the Air Force neglect, but also because of the very public F-22 debate that the Air Force had. It was very retching and you know, a very service soul-searching kind of debate. You know, where are the guys that have been fired? And we don't hear from them. And so that's sending a message to all the guys who think, hey, maybe if I resign, you know, that'll be a statement. I think that's signaling to the guys in office and ladies, you know, don't do that because they've all gone underground for whatever reason, fear or something. And it's a problem because I remember those eras too that you referenced, Al. And there's, I'm not saying I want everyone to quit, but we need that level of honesty and candor. We need people who are able to say no and say it publicly. Yes, I know the chiefs are allowed to say this stuff behind closed doors. And I understand there have been some real knockdown dragouts in the tank. But the wider policymaking community, particularly Congress here, has no idea about that stuff. Let me give you one quick anecdote and I'll stop talking. Clearly, I feel very passionate about this question. So the chiefs and the service secretaries and even, you know, unders at some cases and vice chiefs, you know, the president of the United States is very involved in this new strategy in this 2013 defense budget request. And that's part of the reason you see such unison behind all of the joint chiefs, that their hearts and souls are really, truly signed up for this budget that significantly cuts defense capacity and capability. And their hearts are in the pivot. Why is that? Well, partly it's because the president was so involved, and I give him a lot of credit for doing that. I obviously disagree with the budget cuts that don't match the pivot, but I laud him for taking such a hands-on approach. But, you know, I was told by a senior official recently that in one of those meetings, everybody's at the White House, and they're all sitting around, and there apparently were more than one, somewhere in the neighborhood of 3 or more meetings with Obama himself to talk about the guidance and the assumptions behind defense planning, you know, and with things that event, you know, get to war plans kind of stuff. And basically what the president told everyone in the room, they were discussing certain O plans and the assumptions behind them. And one of the assumptions behind one of the plans is that we needed 100,000 troops to do X. And the president said, well, that new number is going to be 50,000. And everyone says, okay, you know, and he said, well, our allies are going to do, you know, they're going to pick it up. And of course, you know, that's obviously not the way you should be building war planning and contingency planning. But he said, this is the key statement, President Obama said to those in the room reportedly, my goal is to reduce U.S. military activity around the world. And he can do that without these, you know, with all of these other things that I've been talking about, silent generals, you know, we're not seeing the revolt of the admirals, we're not seeing an engaged and, you know, strong oversight Congress. All of these things contribute to a unilateral executive trying to basically cut the military's capacity to tie the hands of the future administration. If you want to do that, do that. But tell everybody what you're doing. Have that conversation with the American people, because I don't think most of them would actually sign up for that. If you want to reduce foreign policy commitments, you do that first, and then you cut the defense budget, but you don't do it the other way around.
Well, at the risk of beating a dead horse, let's talk about the LCS in this context. The Littoral Combat Ship was designed for one mission. Now it seems to be expanding its mission assignments without an increase in its capabilities. I mean, isn't this a perfect example of a place where some admiral or another ought to stand up and go, hey, if we're going to pivot to the Pacific, and I'm not sure it's really a pivot because in my Navy, we always were about 60-40 Westpac or Pacific Atlantic. But isn't this time for one of the admirals to go, wait a minute, how do you expect us to do this with this tool? Is that a good place to start?
Absolutely. And boy, I mean, hats off to you guys. I saw and listened to Undersecretary work at the Navy League, the Aerospace Conference, the annual meeting, and where he said, you know, I follow the military bloggers, and I know, of course, he meant you and information dissemination. And boy, do Navy leaders feel the heat on LCS? Yes, it is. You're absolutely right. It has become the kitchen sink ship. It's going to be the solution to every lower-end contingency unmet need that's happening right now. So, for example, I was laughing, you know, not really, but chuckling when I heard that LCS is now going to be the problem to the you know, decades-long neglect of our minesweeper fleet, and that now it's LCS too. I mean, like, it's going to do everything, right? And obviously, we all know that's not true. And, you know, and we're assuming LCS is built in the numbers that the Navy expects it to be, and we all know that never happens, and it's not going to be up to the Navy, unfortunately. And then you're right, and an LCS can't be, you know, when I thought about this in Japan in particular, forward presence, you know, it's a different kind of forward presence when it's a carrier, destroyer, or a cruiser. When you start plopping LCSs there in Singapore and you're pretending like it's the same capability and therefore the same signal, it deserves a chuckle, because it's not. And that is the perfect example of a program or a conversation or an opportunity for someone to stand up and say, wait a minute, everything you're hearing and reading, Congress, is not true. You know, not that it's not true, but here's what we originally said it was for. Here's what we're saying now, and you figure it out. You see that delta and tell me if this is going to be everything that we say it is. Absolutely agree.
Yeah, I've made the comment for years that as they start displacing water and they leave the PowerPoint slide and come pier side and try to deploy, the facts about the suboptimal nature of that ship's going to take place. And you're talking about Lappy. I also did a little bit of the eye roll when they mentioned Singapore. I'm kind of a history geek. You talk about the worst place in the world to have a Navy make it of any type of impact. Any type of conflict has in that area. You know, Prince of Wales repulsed the Asiatic fleet at the outbreak of World War I. That whole part of the world is a horrible place to have a minimally supported ship, because everything gets sunk real fast and things get going. And, you know, you mentioned something interesting about the president saying, oh, you know, a little wave of the hand, the allies will take care of that. Because one of the things I hope everybody takes away from the experience of the last decade, you know, there are always the right lessons to learn and to take forward, and the wrong lessons to learn to take forward. And I think one of the right lessons to learn is in both capability and will, you have to be very, very realistic on what allies are going to bring to the occasion. We've seen off of the Horn of Africa 23 ships, of which the admiral in charge can actually effectively use 5 because of caveats. Nations will send troops or send ships, but will laden them with so many caveats, you know, whether it's a ship off the Horn of Africa that can do nothing but report radar contacts, even though it's a destroyer, or you have a Belgian contingent at the airport in Afghanistan who will never leave the front gate, even if somebody is shot and bleeding 100 meters down the road. Their allies are very limited. And then when you look at our European allies, their militaries are just shadows of what they used to be able to do. They can barely reach across the Mediterranean to create effects over in North Africa, much less be able to really contribute anything in force. Now, when we go out to the Pacific, Japan, obviously, a percentage of GDP, they don't spend much, but what they do have is quality kit. You know, my father's generation, if they looked at the relative military capability of South Korea, they would be incredibly impressed how much that country's done. Of course, Australia, we have Marines going there. But we really need to be able to show up carrying 90% of the show, don't we? That we really aren't anybody on our team or potentially on our team that can really bring much, but as our Roman predecessors would call, auxiliary forces to the fight.
That's right. And, you know, and no American leader or official would want a future where they can't determine or control how we show up. The idea that you can pool resources when everybody's shrinking and declining in terms of your, in many cases, your allies and your partners is ridiculous, because it's a rapidly shrinking pool. And, you know, I'm just making a very broad brush statement here, but you know, the West is cutting defense pretty significantly and at a fast clip. The East is not. I see terms every day in the newspaper, Asian arms race. I see all of the defense budget stories where countries in the Pacific are growing their militaries and their budgets pretty significantly. You know, there's a reason since the end of World War II why the U.S. military looks like it does and why it has global reach and global power and global capacity, and it's exactly how you characterized it. We want, well, one, obviously our interests are global, and no other country on earth has that. What we have, our unique set of interests, spans every corner of the earth. So we need a military that can go anywhere and do anything. And we've never said that we're going to rely on somebody else to get us there. I think it's we've always had the capability organically, and we're starting to give that up. We're seeing it in space, for example. You're seeing it in some of the things you've mentioned. And the allies are notoriously unreliable, as you already said, the caveats. I mean, yes, ask an Army soldier or a Marine about caveats in Afghanistan like you described, and they will tell you how challenging it has been in many cases. The notion that we can all pool together resources and then come out of a conflict. And like, say, for example, a Libya, you know, when the UK ran out of precision-guided munitions, I think it was day three. I'm probably wrong in that, so please don't hold me to it. But it was shocking and embarrassing. First week, thank you. I mean, is that really the future that we want to put our guys and girls in? And, you know, finally, is it also what we're telling them? I mean, part of the reason we have the military technological overmatch that we've had for so long, it's because of that contract we have with those in uniform. And I don't mean their benefits and their compensation. I mean that we don't want you in a fair fight, because, you know, we don't want to lose blood and treasure, particularly blood in this case, because you're worth it. And so therefore, we always want to be better than everybody else. We're starting to equalize ourselves by our own choosing with everybody else. And this allies will contribute notion is going to feed that cycle even faster. And what it ultimately means is that's a backdoor way of changing the contract. And I think that's a horrifying thought. If I was going to say my son's going to raise his hand in 10 years, I would be concerned about that changing of the contract.
Well, I'm concerned because of a lot of other things, but having two sons serving, where the devil is the logistics thing on this? I mean, are they not, if they're going to do the Pacific pivot, I would assume on a strategic point of view, strategic logistics would come into play, and we'd be really looking at how do we arm these guys, how do we keep them armed, how do we support them out in the field, and I don't hear that being discussed anywhere. In fact, that is probably the quietest area of the military right now. Have you heard anything on the how we plan to support the Pacific, the Western Pacific fleet or anything?
I haven't, and I think you're right. I think there, not only is it not too quiet, I don't know that there is a lot of analysis behind it, and which makes me, again, have a cynical eye towards what this pivot really is, because you're absolutely right. It kind of falls along, although I will say an exception is the Marine Corps. I did have the opportunity to attend a war game last year, Marine Corps logistics. It was impressive, but this was pre-pivot, so totally different time. You know, this kind of follows from, I hear this is a comment across the defense budget, you know, bumper sticker statements that we get out of the administration. And so, for example, you know, we're going to cut the Army and Marine Corps by 100,000 active duty troops, but we're going to grow special operations forces. Okay, but if you're going to cut the guys that support them, that supply them, that fly them, that train, you know, that they recruit from, the, you know, general operating and general purpose forces, you're going to hurt the special operations forces. You can't do one and not the other. And it falls along the lines similarly, I think, here, this point about logistics. We're talking about a pivot, but everything that actually is required to put it into motion and make it happen is not happening. And it's, again, that's why I think this administration is wide open on it. And I know why they're doing it. They're doing it because I go back to the first 10 minutes. They're doing it because they're trying to meet a budget bogey, plain and simple, a bogey that both parties signed up to in the debt ceiling deal. And the problem is, not that they're trying to meet the budget, but that they're trying to keep a straight face on the strategy. And when we all know that this was for one reason, it was to cut the defense budget in the name of debt reduction. And it's, you know, we're past the point, I think, of silly on a lot of this. And the analysis really isn't there in many cases.
I wanted to go towards personalities here. And because when you think your national security, your foreign policy team, a lot of times if you have a change in party, or even when you don't have a change in party, usually from first term to second term, people will move along, so to speak, and a fresh team will come in. But Governor Romney, if he were to defeat President Obama in November, and you try to think, okay, well, who is he going to bring along on his national security and DOD team? I think Secretary Gates, his card is punched out and complete. I don't think you'll see him again for obvious reasons. You're not going to see Colin Powell or his buddy Armitage anywhere in the hopefully the tri-state area. I don't think Mr. Bolton will be around. Condoleezza Rice, I think, has made it clear that her fun card is complete as well. Obviously, there were some people that were making things happen in the background that weren't maybe marquee players in the previous Republican administration. Who are some names out there people might recognize? Or even more importantly, who are some of the players out there on the Romney team that people should probably Google and research in case things go Governor Romney's way in the election? Because people do matter.
They do matter. Oh, tremendously so. The vision matters if there is one, but the people execute that vision. And this is a candidate, in full disclosure, I advise Governor Romney informally on the defense team. And this is my first and last presidential campaign. I can tell you that right now. Nonetheless, people matter because, you know, they will make your vision a success or not. And it's time for some fresh blood in the conservative defense circles. I'm going to just put it out there and say the elephant in the room for conservatives. We cannot continue to go back to the same old people over and over. It's not healthy. It's not healthy for any party, but conservatives tend to do it more often, and that's why I'm picking on them. It's time to build a deeper bench in the defense space, and I hope Governor Romney and his team will do that. You know, the last two secretaries of defense including this one. I mean, these guys are getting up there. Many, two of them in their 70s. I mean, it's just time, again, for some fresh blood. And I mean not just at the SecDef and the service secretary levels, but, you know, the middle bench, you know, the sort of the undersecretaries and the assistant secretaries and same, you know, across the board.
But before, I just want to break in because you mentioned.
Yep.
You're right. Yeah, things get geriatric real fast. What I find really eye opening. These are some people who did some great things. You look at who was doing, not just the second layer and the third layer, but the first layer, in Eisenhower and John F. Kennedy's administration. There was a lot of young blood and generational diversity in there. That I think you hit a really interesting topic, is the fact that there's a little bit of intellectual inbreeding going on there that might not be helping us too much.
Absolutely. And we're not doing the work. You know, it's only going to hurt Republicans at the end. I know not all Republicans are conservative, but they tend to affiliate Republicans. It's going to hurt Republicans because there isn't a new generation to turn over the keys to. And that's the problem. If you look at the Obama Pentagon, you know, you love them or hate them or indifferent, they have been brilliant at bringing along young, smart people. You know, now former Undersecretary of Defense Policy, Flournoy, you know, she is truly deserves nothing but the utmost respect for doing this, for example, in her shop. So, you know, where are this 20, 30, and 40-somethings smart people in defense? I'm going to just tell you, we're missing them. And so, hey, any listeners out there, call McKenzie if you want to talk about this. But I can tell you a couple names that you should read. And I think it's, I always say when anyone asks me, like, you know, who's the VP pick for Romney, because, of course, I don't know. But when people ask me, who do you think he would pick for the Secretary of Defense, I say, that's the right question that you should be asking. And, of course, we're talking other positions, too. But I would first look to the QDR Independent Panel membership. This was a group, I've referenced it already. In 2010, it was stood up to review. This was, remember, the Gates QDR that started all the budget cuts for the military, and Congress had a skeptical eye, to say the least. They stood up this commission. It was 20 members. It was majority democratically appointed, but nonetheless bipartisan. It was 12 and 8, I believe, the composition. Kind of like the graybeards, as we call them, defense people, you know, but younger ones on there too. It was an outstanding group that worked together brilliantly, and they produced a quality product that's still timely. Again, I told you, this panel, the QDR independent panel, called for the pivot before there was a pivot. And, of course, properly resourced the pivot. They have some really cutting-edge ideas on acquisition and how to do it better. And I know we all roll our eyes on acquisition, but this group has some great, smart ideas. So I would look there first, and then I would start to think about who are some sea power thinkers that are conservative. The first one that comes to mind for me is Jim Talent. He's former senator from Missouri. He was sea power subcommittee chairman on the Senate Armed Services Committee. A great legislator, somebody who really, the kind of guy we talked about that doesn't really exist anymore on the Hill, or exists in too few numbers. Jim Talent educated himself with a district that didn't necessarily have a parochial interest in the Navy, and he was in the House before he was in the Senate, and made himself truly a national thinker on defense policy issues, and his heart is with sea power, and that would make you smile, I'm sure. As part of the Romney Defense Policy Group, one of our co-chairmen is John Layman, so I know that's a name familiar to many, everybody, and, you know, he's a part of the team. He's thinking some things through. We have other members, other guests who have been on your show that have contributed to the Romney Defense Policy Team. So those are some names, and I think it's really wise of you to want to ask the question and encourage people to look them up and learn more about them.
Well, we're nearing the end of the show, McKenzie. What are you working on? What can we look forward to, and where are you doing it?
Thank you. Yes, thanks for having me. It's always a pleasure, and I hope the same for you. You know, I'm now at the American Enterprise Institute. I was at the Heritage Foundation before. We've got a lot of things cooking. A couple of reports in the sequestration is just chief among them. It's certainly filling up a lot of my time because it's something that members urgently want to deal with but cannot address until the lame duck, apparently, the lame duck session of Congress. But it's a huge deal. It's out there, it's looming, it's not, the uncertainty about it isn't going away. And so that's what Congress cares about, and that's therefore what I care about too. But I'm also spending a lot of time looking at sea and air power, you know, just kind of a new thinking in some ways, air-sea battle to some extent, kind of a vision for the future now that, for example, the Air Force is going to have a new chief of staff. There's a good opportunity for someone to come in and sort of take the service in a different direction if that is what is in fact needed. So I'm looking at these issues, but I'm also looking at, coming out shortly, I've got a paper on Pentagon and military risk management. You know, we've heard a lot of the chiefs have said, you know, when the budget cuts too far and too deep, like the Navy in some cases, we've heard the solution to those challenges is that the Navy will absorb or assume more risk. It is a bumper sticker statement. It has no depth or meaning behind it in that moment. There's very little analysis going back to the logistics point behind it. And I'm greatly concerned because assuming more risk is borne on the backs of sailors and Marines and everybody.
Exactly.
And it has serious implications. It has mission failure implications. It has increased casualty and KIA implications. It has reduced readiness implications. I mean, there's a lot of color here, and nobody understands on Capitol Hill what the heck it means. And I don't know that the Pentagon leadership understands it fully. I don't know that they're modeling it, that they understand it on the strategic and the operational and the tactical levels. There's just a lot going on there. So I'm looking at risk management, and I'm also looking at the other bumper sticker solution has been that DOD says we're going to cut all these major systems and assets, but we're going to invest in seed corn for the future, high-end R&D and S&T programs. And to some extent, they're doing that. But I've looked at the Navy's programs, and a lot of them that would be applicable to air-sea battle are getting cut. So I'm looking at this notion of seed corn and what are the experimental programs, the programs that are cutting edge, that are going to make a leap ahead investment in the future, and, where they should be maintaining investment under any circumstance, any president, and I'm going to put that out any day now.
Wow, well, I'll tell you, that is a great list, and I'll tell you, McKinsey, I am so glad that you're hitting on that risk issue, because I get a twitch in my eye every time somebody says, assume more risk. It's a polite way of saying, we're going to have more sailors and Marines die, because you want to. It's the equivalent of I used to tease my British colleagues, their initial individual body armor that they would wear, that beginning part of the last decade, it literally was about a 6-inch by 6-inch square above their heart, that they their armorers assumed more risk. It will protect your heart. Your lungs and your liver and everything else is toast. And as long as you get shot from the front, you're all right. So that when you said risk, that's the first thing I thought of. Yeah, it's a little strike plate over your heart. Everything else is fair game to be hit. But this has been a real quick hour, McKinsey, and I'm really looking forward to reading the stuff you're doing over at American Enterprise Institute, and I would encourage everybody else to keep track of you and the work you go. And you're playing around with the presidential election, so enjoy your 4 hours of sleep and have a great summer, McKinsey.
Thanks again. Thanks for having me. It's been my pleasure.
Thanks, McKinsey. Enjoyed it.
Thank you
very much for everybody for joining us today for Mid-Wraps. I hope everybody has a great week and a great Navy Day. We'll see you next week for another edition of Mid-Wraps.
Maloney wants to marry me, and so leave the Strand and Piccadilly, or you'll be to blame. For love has fairly drove me silly, hoping you're the same.
It's a long way to Tipperary, it's a long way to go, it's a long way to Tipperary.
Goodbye, Piccadilly.